Okay. Not okay. So where are we? We created a Hilbert space, and then we found some generic states. But then we know that we have some constraints on the states, on the physics. I mean, to get the physical states, we need to impose some constraints, right? So we impose the Gauss constraint that I think Katharina summarized yesterday. But we also have the flatness constraint to implement. So if you give me a path gamma, I can have the holonomy. And if gamma is very small, we can develop the holonomy at first order. And we found something like this. Okay? So if I want to require flatness, which means if I want f is equal to 0, I can simply ask that my holonomy is identity, which means that if I turn around the path, my arrow doesn't change at the end. Okay, I have no shift of the arrow. So now that we are going, what are we going to do? Please. We take a particular example as a tetrahedron, so it's just a sphere. So if you inflate this, you get a sphere. So on my tetrahedron, I have 6 vertices. On each vertex, I put an arrow, which is arbitrary, but I just have to be consistent. And on, okay, sorry. On each edge, I put an arrow, which then I associated a group holonomy element. And then on each of the 4 faces, I have to impose the flatness constraints. I basically want to ask that the holonomy around these faces and the other one, is identity. So how do we implement this? So let's take a particular example. For example, H1 is, okay, let's take this face, okay? So you start from here. When you swim along the arrow, you put a -1. So for example, here, -1. Then again, you have the arrow, which is in the same direction. You put a -1. But here, you swim against the arrow, so you don't put the -1. And then that gives you the constraints. So for example, this is the holonomy around this face. And we want this holonomy to be 1. You do the same for four faces. So you get 4 constraints. But what happens is that one of them is depends on the other one. You can see it like this. If you start from here and you do this, okay, and then you do this for this face and this for this face, you have gone through all of these vertical vertices 2 times, but in opposite order. So you basically cancel each of them, but you have done all of these vertices once. So basically, it means that if you know how to constrain this face, and this face, the 4th one is going to be automatically constrained. Okay? So even if it looks that I have 4 constraints, I can just impose 3 of them. Okay? If I impose the 4 of them, I will have like delta square, which is very annoying. So I have to be careful of this. Okay? Now, we need to use the delta H function to create the physical states. So phi 1 and phi 2 are generic states that satisfy the Gauss constraints, but not the flatness constraints. So if I want to have a physical observable, a physical scalar product, I need to apply the delta function on my states. So the delta function is kind of inverse projectors. Okay? If you give me a state and you put the delta functions, it will give you a state after that satisfies the flatness constraint. Okay? And my question is, what is the amplitude of transition between these physical states and these physical states? So I need to use the physical scalar product. But this one is very naughty, because we don't know this scalar product, so we need to use a trick. Fortunately, we have that the delta is Hermitian, and delta is a projector. So I can, all of those delta, by hermeticity, I can put them on the right, and then I will have delta square, but by the fact that it's a projector, the delta square becomes just a delta. Then there is a little trick, which means that when I put all of those delta on the right, for some reason, I can replace this physical scalar product by the kinematical scalar product that I know, okay? And then I can perform the computation. So let's take a particular example. We have seen that the states phi 1 and phi 2 cannot be arbitrary, but they have to be spin network, okay? So it means that at each phi 1 is associated with a list of ji on each edge. Okay, so I take 2 such states, and I want to compute the transition probability. Okay? So I don't give you the details because it's a bit pedantic, but what happened is that we want to compute this with the kinematical scalar product. We insert a bunch of resolution of the identity. We perform integration over a lot of SU2 elements. Then we have the magic recoupling identity that Katharina present. And at the end, we found something like this. Okay? So how can you read this? You can read that the scalar product between phi 1 and phi 2 is given by the norm of phi 1 and the norm of phi 2. Now, if you recall your high school theory of scalar products, you know that scalar product is equal to norm of phi 1 times norm of phi 2 times the cosinus of the angle between the two vectors. But you see that this is true for every phi 1 and phi 2, which means that this cosinus is actually equal to 1. So you don't have a vector space which is like this, with one vector like this, one like this. Actually, your vector space is like this. Okay? The angle between the vectors has to be pi or 0. What does that mean? That actually this Hilbert space is one-dimensional. Okay? But then, by the normalization constraints, if you have a vector space of dimension 1, you normalize your states, you have only one state. Okay? So the moral of the story is that the phase space is zero-dimensional. You have only one state, which is allowed. And the stuff is that if you give me a graph associated to a space-time, the state is fully determined. You have no personal choice about the evolution or the physical evolution on this graph. And so in 3D, actually, we found that we have no degree of freedom. Ta-da!
Yeah, thanks a lot. Perfect. Okay, so let me try. So from I'm just trying to figure out how I can move on that. just regarding the last slide, maybe just let's focus on the last slide. So yeah, we have 0 degrees of freedom, but it's not given any kind of graph. It's also depending on, the topology of the... And the calculation we did was for the topology of a sphere, so the topology is trivial. So in this case, indeed, we find only one physical state. Okay, great. So what I'm going to do today, I'm going to try to give you what we have done until now and which steps can be generalized to 4D gravity and what are the differences, okay? So I already wrote something.
Question.
Yeah.
You're saying that we have a one-dimensional Hilbert space, and then...
Yeah, it's just it's more the identity, if you want. It's just the spin network. It's in the, for the given graph, the sig j can be seen as the identity of your... Okay, so you still have one state. It's because you have 0 degrees of freedom, it's what your question.
Yeah.
So it's more the identity of your,
and we know
of your state, okay?
Because of the things we've done with the constraints and that.
Yeah, it's because, so if you expect more degrees of freedom, then you don't have only one state. You would expect additional state, but 0 degrees of freedom mean, in the case of the Hilbert space, one physical independent state, which is more or less the identity. Okay, good. So now we want to see what we can take going from 3D to 4D. Okay. So from 3D, what we have done, we started from the Einstein-Hilbert action. So again, I remind you that what we have done right now is very simple because, so first we look at Euclidean gravity, 3D gravity and without any matter field or anything, okay? So it's the simplest system that, so what we have quantized at the end is indeed the gravitational field, but without any matter field and without cosmological constant in 3D and with the Euclidean signature. So this was our starting point. Then we introduced the first order formalism where we introduced the triad and a connection where we get then the Palatini action. And on this Palatini action, we perform the canonical analysis. From that, we get some canonical variable, some constraints. So the system is totally constrained, meaning that your Hamiltonian can be written as a linear combination of your constraint. And on that, we apply the Dirac program. OK, so what in 4D can we do? So in 4D, you could start the same, start from the Einstein-Hilbert action in 4D. Then go to the first order formulation, get the Palatini action, which is would look like so now it's not linear anymore. So what here was interesting is that this was linear in the triad. So now we have some tetrad. And but so for this action, the invariance is a Lorentz invariance. Okay, so what you introduce in addition to here, so here you still have it's still invariant by DiFeo. And so if we would do the same, go to really what is loop quantum gravity in 4D, we should add another additional step here, which would be a gauge fixing, a partial gauge fixing. Which is a time gauge. And we call that the time gauge usually to go to a SU2 gauge invariant. So this could be one route, and then we would do the canonical analysis on this action.
Why is this extra step required? Sorry, I didn't.
So it just, so to go to loop quantum gravity as it is defined now, okay, it's defined with SU2 spin network, okay, so you know the result. So if you want, and here, so this group is not is not compact, so usually what is done is to do the, if you start from this section, would be to do this gauge fixing to get to the SU2 gauge group, okay? But historically, so in the literature, in fact, usually you don't really see starting from here, because what has been done is that the canonical analysis, in fact, has been performed directly on the Einstein-Hilbert action. So, and it's what I'm going to explain to you now. So this is, would be, if you really want to mimic what we have done in 3D starting from this Palatini action. But here, what can be the way the Hashtegger-Barbero variable have been introduced is starting, so what was done at this time? So the first idea was, okay, we start with Einstein-Hilbert action. We do the canonical analysis here. So what does it mean? This means that you have your space-time. You're going to perform a 3+1 splitting of your space-time. So you get a space, which is three-dimensional. And then you look at what we did here. What are the variables with the time derivative? And so what you get here is as variable for your phase space variable. So you have the spatial metric QA in B, which is, so it's just the metric defined on, so the metric on sigma here, where A, B here are space indices. And then you have the conjugated momentum. Which is just defined by, so if you have your Lagrangian And this function now is related to the extrinsic curvature. This is extrinsic curvature . So these are your variable. Then, of course, you're going to get some constraints. So what are the constraints? So you have some variable, so your phase space variable, and it's a constraint system, of course. So what are the constraints here? You're going to get the vector constraint, which are special DFEO, okay, DFEO on your hypersurface sigma. And you have the scalar constraint, which can be seen as the time. Introducing time reparameterization, generating the time reparameterization. And so then from that, you can combine that together to get some constraint which generate the DFEO. So these constraints are first class. Okay, and this formalism, doing the canonical analysis of this Einstein-Hilbert action, is what we call the ADM formalism. And then, of course, at this stage, people have tried to apply the Dirac program. But so then what was the issue at this stage is that the H mu here, so for the Dirac program, is it possible . The issue here is that this H mu are non-polynomial function of the phase space variable. So the spatial metric and function of the phase space variable. And so we don't really know how to apply the Dirac program to this formulation. Okay, so then this is where Ashtekar. So I already talked about him in maybe the first day of. So it's Abhay Ashtekar is at Penn State, and in the 80s, I would say, introduced. He did a change of variable. So really what I'm giving you is more or less the historical construction of loop quantum gravity. But even going again, if you want to go by the first order formalism from at 4D, then you have this a bit complicated. You need to do this gauge fixing. And again, then to define really what are the variables that he introduced, it's not so direct, in fact. So that's why it's easier to see this from this perspective. Okay. So what is the change of variable that he did? He used, so here you see that this metric now, QNB, is defined on three-dimensional manifold, okay, on your three-dimensional hypersurface. So here we can do exactly what we did in 3D, in fact. It's really introduced at each point of your hypersurface a small frame in terms of a triad. Whereas here, if you look at the Palatini action I wrote for 4D, the EI, are what we call a tetrad, okay? It's one additional index. Whereas here, what we're going to introduce is directly triad, exactly as we did in 3D. So you see that it's at this stage that we define Q and B as and of course, introducing this variable, now you are on the 3D, okay? So at each point, you have a small frame that again, you can rotate this small frame, but again, now the symmetry that you introduce, the additional symmetry is as before, is the rotation symmetry that we can see that as SU2 symmetry, now that you're familiar with how to go from SO3 to SO2. So here we have additional degrees of freedom. And so you see that everything we did for SU2, in fact, is valid also in 4D, because now it's an additional SU2 gauge symmetry that we have, which is very similar to what we did in 3D. So in fact, when I'm going to now rewrite what are my constraints, so I'm going to still get these two constraints, so the scalar constraint and the vector constraint, but I'm going to get also a Gauss constraint as before. And if you remember, what was very simple in 3D is that, of course, this action, Einstein-Hilbert action here, is invariant under DFAO, okay? But what makes things very simple in 3D is that the DFAO symmetry could be replaced by the Gauss plus a translation symmetry generated by this flatness constraint here, at least on shell. Whereas, of course, here we won't have this simplification, so we will have to work with these two constraints. We generate really the DFAO and the Gauss constraint here. So here we get an additional constraint. We're going to get an additional constraint G. Okay, so now what are the variables really introduced by Hashtagger, because it's not only this change of variable, then in fact you have a kind of, you need to do a Legendre transform. And so what are the Hashtagger-Barbero variables here? So again, we have the densitized, as in 3D, we have a densitized triad given by epsilon AGK which would come from also just the canonical rewriting everything in terms of this variable. And we have the Hashtagger Barbero connection, where here we have something new compared to the 3D case, is that we don't have only one connection, but we have a family of connection that can be defined. And at the classical level, everything is the same, but at the quantum level, it might be relevant. So what are this? This is just the Levi-Civita connection. And this is a SU2 connection, okay? Maybe. This is the extrinsic curvature. It's a one form here. And here, this is a parameter which is called the Imirzi. And so initially, when Hashtagger introduced this variable, he didn't introduce a family of connection. He just introduced one when gamma was just equal to I. So it was just an imaginary number, okay? But then the issue is that if you work with high here, then you get additional constraints, which are reality constraints. Okay, at the end, you want that your theory is real. So you if you do the analysis, you end up with some additional constraints, which are reality constraints, and these constraints are going to be second class. So things were getting not so easy to deal with. So then people noticed that you can in fact define this with a now the one we are considering is gamma is a real number, okay, and using this definition, then you end up with only you don't have any additional constraint, and it's a first class constraint. But there are still some discussion even today to know if this parameter, the way it is used, is the correct way. So this is also still part of some discussion. And so when I is here, you get the self-dual formulation, okay, in terms of I, and then you get the conjugated variable. So also, why some people are not really happy about this connection is because so this connection cannot be seen as a pullback of the pullback of a space-time connection to this surface sigma. Okay, so this makes things that this interpretation of this connection is not really nice. So these are still some discussion, but so here these are conjugated variable, and it's the one we're going to use to define our theory. Okay, so now we're working on and you can see that now it's quite similar. So if you just work at this level with the densitized thread and the SU2 connection, it's very similar to what we had in 3D. Okay. Yeah.
So all these problems that we have now is because we're considering a Lorentz invariant, so 4D gravity with a Lorentz signature. But if it was just with the Euclidean, could we just use first order formulation again and have it become?
No, it will be the same because it will be SO4. Okay.
Isn't SO4 a breakdown of SU2?
Yeah, it can be written as SU2 times SU2, but if you want to. Depending on what you want, okay? But so historically, this has been defined this way, and why people really like this is because then it's a SU2 gauge theory, so it can be really compared to SU2 lattice gauge theory, okay? So then this was introduced really, as I told you, okay, people were stuck here doing the ADM formalism, so Ashikar came and did, okay, we can at this stage change variable on this hypersurface, and then we get something which is really nice because it's a SU2 gauge theory, okay? And then you are going to see that, in fact, since it's going to be exactly the same thing, and in 3D, we can define spin network state, and we can solve this constraint. So then, of course, we are still open problem with this constraint, but things got very smoothly until this stage. So then, of course, there have been questions on, but how do we get to covariant formulation? So let's go back to the first order formulation at this day, and what can we say? Can we define spin network? What does it mean to define? Do we define spin network even for SO4? I would say that in 4D, you could work with Euclidean signature, but at the end, what you want is anyway, it's Lorentzian signature. Okay, so it's not because you can manage the SO4 case that it's going to give you much more to. Okay, because the issue comes from here, the non-compactness of the group. So it's not, whereas here, even with Lorentzian, you can define this SU2 signature. Okay, so these are conjugated variables. So you get some factor that in 3D, I put this one to one, but here we have this additional gamma coming out. And then of course, we just have AB. And again, it's filled. Plus, we have first class constraints, which are now. So this is our phase space, and it's a constraint. Sorry, so we get Now, a Gauss constraint, the Victor constraint, and the scalar constraint. Okay, and these are first class. And as we did in 3D, the next step is to check that they are first class. In fact, what we're doing is that we are smearing the constraint. And then we compute the constraint algebra. And we and in fact, therefore, yeah, it's a bit more complicated than just first class. Because so what do we get for the constraint algebra? So I'm just going to give you so here I'm now considering smeared constraint, really as we did in 3D, okay? So these are the smearing coefficient, if you want. And again, here you get the same result as in 3D, it's just rotation. So you expect that two rotation give you a rotation. Then now you look at the Poisson bracket with the Gauss and the Victor constraint, and this is going to be still a rotation, but here you get so the Lie derivative of alpha. So I'm not going to give you too many details, but you will see why I want to give you this is because in fact it's not as simple that in 3D. So here this commute, and then we still need V between. And this can be given by a scalar constraint, where again, we have the Lie derivative of n and
LNN?
M, sorry, yeah. And then the last one, which is the one which is going to give us some trouble, is between the scalar constraint themselves. Channel to the Gauss constraint here, but these are not the one. But here, so the issue comes from this term, okay? And in fact, this algebra, we're going to say that. So this algebra, in fact, does not close in the usual sense, okay, which is what we say. So meaning usual sense here. Which, what does it mean? This means that the structure constant that we have here is given by, is a field, okay, which depends, it's a space-time, it depends on the phase space function, okay, so it's a field. But the issue here is that this field is given by the inverse of the metric here. And so this will be, in general, a non-polynomial function of the basic variables. Okay, so here, that's why we say that it doesn't close in this sense. It's going to be non-polynomial, okay? In the non-polynomial in the phase space variable. So in fact, we don't have really a representation space. So at this stage, we don't have really a representation of this algebra. So this is the representation of this complete algebra is still missing. Okay, so this is one. Yeah.
The second last line is that vector with scalar, F scalar.
Sorry?
The second last line.
Yeah.
That vector with scalar giving a scalar.
Yeah, and I'm missing a line. No? Yeah, you're right. It should be. Yeah. And so I guess I'm missing the two vector with vector, which is, I don't remember like this, but it will be vector. So you will get something. But so here it's. Yeah, so this has to be a vector. Yeah, OK. Let's say that, but to check. So I will check, check that in the lecture note this is correctly written. So this would be something V, but I need to check what is here. Yeah, thanks. OK, so here, this is one issue that we have. We still do not have a proper representation of this algebra. Okay, so this is one issue we have at this stage. But so now, so this is one of the difficulties, of course. But we can still try to apply the Dirac program here. So where are we on this blackboard?
Maite?
Yeah?
In the, well, this algebra does not close in the VRS. What is VRS?
So here, what? So VRS stands, so mean, so I cannot give you what the B, R, and S are for here. But just what does it mean? This means that here, the structure constants that you get here are not like, usually they are just, can be just written in terms of the other constraints. So you don't have any field here appearing here. Okay, so here, what does it mean that it does not close in the same sense? It means that here you have some complicated constant structure, which are fields. And even here, they are depending on non-polynomial function of your phase space variables. So so I cannot give you much more detail on this. But so here, just what does this mean? It's mean in the standard, more or less sense, when usually you have, when you say that this is closing, so this means that, of course, what you have on this side is also a constraint, but the structure constant of your constraint is just a function of the other structure constant usually, okay? So you don't have that this is a field and it's then a phase space function, okay? Okay, so where are we here? So then, so we're done with the canonical analysis. So what was important was to what are our phase space variables, the constraint. Which kind of constraint do we have? Are they first class or not? So here we have this subtlety here that means that it's not so simple to find a representation of this algebra because of this term in this case. But we can still start to apply the Dirac program. And so the first step is to define the basic variables. So here we are also dealing with the SU2 connection. So our configuration variables are still connection, and we are still going to work with holonomies, okay? So for the Dirac program, so the definition, in fact, of the kinematical definition of the kinematical Hilbert space is identical to the 3D case, more or less. Well, at least it's really similar. So what do I mean here? I mean, instead of, so we are going to smear our basic our phase space variable. So the connection is going to be smeared. And now we're going to work with holonomies. But you, if you remember the recipe I gave you, remember that the recipe in order to avoid, so why we introduce smeared variable, remember it was to avoid any delta function and also any integral in the Poisson bracket in order to turn that into operators. And so the recipe was, as once you have chosen how to smear your configuration variable, if they are smeared on a, so here it's a one-dimensional object, okay? So smear then the conjugated variable would be smeared on d minus, so here one, where d here is, so we are living on a, our upper surface is three-dimensional. Okay, so now it's going to be two-dimensional. So this means that we're going to smear the over surfaces. But I'm going to come back on that. So just with the holonomy, so the holonomy are configuration variables. So then, of course, we are going to consider, we can build really the kinematical Hilbert space the same way. So first we look at one edge, then a graph, so a collection of edges, okay? So we are going to work with square integrable function over SU2. And then the merger. So here I didn't give too many details, but here you have some subtleties when you go to a given graph, okay? Because then the question is, if you consider all possible graphs, not only for one given graph, but all possible graphs, and you want to take the scalar product between two functions defined on, for example, two different graphs, how do you define this scalar product? Okay, so you have some, so one idea is to say that if you have two given graphs, you can always find a bigger graph in which the two graphs are included, okay, and you can define your scalar product with that. But so this is really, the idea without many details, mathematically it can be shown that you can really define a well-defined measure, and this measure is called the Hdk-Lewandowski. So here, Lewandowski measure. So in the literature, maybe you're going to see this notation. And it's given because you can have any graph. And then usually you introduce also a function to define your state. So how, so this is what we call also cylindrical function. So I didn't give you all these details because it's technical details that you don't really know need in 3D. Just in case you see the, so what is the idea now is that, so if you define the scalar product, it's just going to be defined as I'm not going to define this carefully. So just the scalar product between two functions now, which can be defined with two different graphs, okay? This can be taken into account using the Hdk-Lewandowski measure, okay? So this is mathematically, everything is well defined. So really the idea of this measure is to deal with when you consider function or spin network, not spin network yet, but function on the group defined for different graphs. Okay. So it's when you need to introduce this specific measure. Okay, so this is to define. So this was because we need an inner product. Okay. And then we can define an orthonormal basis. But as in 3D, we can just take matrix element of SU2. So we're just going to work same kind of basis. Okay? So what is going to be then on that, when we have this, we can define, we can impose the Gauss constraint. And this is very similar to what we have done, meaning we can impose it using a group averaging, okay, using the interpretation. And so what did we get here? Once we impose the Gauss constraint, we introduce spin network states, okay? And so in 4D, you have the same object describing which form a complete basis of the Hilbert space of solution of the quantum Gauss constraint. So here, what do you get? You get spin network state, which are really what we call the fundamental excitation of space. And as in 3D, there are graph, oriented graph, okay, decorated. So each node is decorated with the SU2 representation and the Gauss constraint imposed here that here you have an intertwiner. Okay. So this is GE, and then this is E for the given vertex. And the spin network state, so they form, as in 3D, a complete basis. Of the Hilbert space of solution of the Gauss constraint. Okay, and so in 3D, so what did we do at this stage before even imposing the the Gauss constraint here and defining spin network state, we even before that we define the length for on this Hilbert space, we define the length operator. And we show that the spectrum of this operator was discrete. Okay, so what do we have here in 4D? So as I said, the triad is smeared over the surface, and what we get is what we call the flux. Okay, it's a two-form, and so now in a similar way that we define the length operator in 3D, now we can define the area operator. Okay, and so what is this area operator? So now to each, so this is a given edge. Okay, and before this was what was dual to edge in 2D was another curve, but now it's a surface, okay? And you need to use this surface to define your flux variable, since that's smeared over a 2D object, which are these dual surfaces. And so what can we say about this area operator? The action of this operator is going to be diagonalized. So I'm not giving you too many details because I don't really have the time here. And really, many things can be generalized to what you did in 3D. diagonalized so by the spin network state. You can directly work with spin network state. And so if I implement, if I act with my operator on a given spin network, what I'm going to get is, so for this case, so let's say that this is just the state associated to one edge here. What I'm going to get is that this is, so you have some factor, it's proportional to the Planck length squared. Okay, I also have the gamma, the Imirzi parameter now, and I have the same. In fact, if you do the calculation, it's very similar to the length operator. So you recover that you get the Casimir here of the value of the Casimir here of SU2. Okay, and this is valid when you have a single puncture, meaning that you look just at the area operator defined for on, so this is, for example, in this case, S. But if you look at something more complicated where you have several edges, so for example, I think on Thursday, Hal is going to talk about black hole, okay? And so for a black hole, you're going to, what you're interested in is the surface of the black hole. And you can see that many spin network can be going out of the surface, okay? And the way you compute the area to relate that to the entropy of your black hole is using exactly this, but now you need to sum over all. So each edge is going to be associated with a given J representation. So you sum over all the possible J. Here, this expression is just when you have a single puncture. So this should, I think, will be mentioned on Thursday in the case of black hole physics. Yeah?
So gamma is the Imirzi parameter, is a parameter that's introduced into the theory. You said it was originally taken to be imaginary?
Yeah.
Would that then change this area formula?
Yeah, so then to get, when it's imaginary, then you need to, at some point, you need to impose, of course, reality condition, okay? Because what you want is that, but of course, then in this case, you won't have a factor here, okay, in this situation. But what you're going to see if in the black hole physics is that indeed this factor, so right now, the way we define loop quantum gravity is using this Imirzi parameter being a real parameter. As I told you, there are still some discussion on what really this parameter means, and is it the right way to define at the beginning the Hd-Carbar-Biro variable. But most of the work are now done with this Imirzi parameter being real. And then if you look at now, we can compute the entropy of a black hole is going to be related to the area, and you get this factor entering. So
compare it to the Bekenstein.
Yeah, then. And then, so having this kind of result mean, can we say something that at some point, if we can fix this factor or not? Okay, so this with this kind of calculations, it's entering this kind of calculation that can be done in other contexts. Then what does it give us on this factor? But yeah, I think you will know maybe a bit more. I just want to finish quickly. To give you where we are. So we know how to quantize. We have this operator. We can also define the volume operator. Okay. And so what do we get at the end is that, so again, here we get a discrete spectrum. And so the property of this area and volume operator just provide a very simple geometric interpretation. This means that now, the way we interpret spin network state is that an edge is going to carry a quanta of area, okay, given by this SU2 number. So this is a quanta of area. And in fact, we can, if you compute the volume operator, you can see that it's going to be a discrete spectrum written in terms of the an intertwiner now. So vertices are going to carry a quanta of volume. And here, what is important is that the embedding or the coordinate system that you choose to draw the spin, if you want to draw your spin network, for example, graph, it does not carry any physical interpretation. Okay, what all the information about the degrees of freedom of the geometry, so meaning the gravitational field, is contained just in this combinatoric aspect of the graph. What is connected to what? And in the discrete quantum number, labeling quanta of area and volumes here. Okay. So the next step. So this is a bit the picture that you have once you. So in 3D, it would be once we have implemented this Gauss constraint. So we have the spin network state. We know how to define the area and volume operator. So we have a kind of geometrical interpretation of this state. Of course, as someone or maybe even more than just one, few already mentioned to me that here we are defining operators and they are not observables, okay? Because they are not Dirac observables, because we are working still in the kinematical Hilbert space, even if we already implemented the Gauss constraint. So we don't have a complete theory. So maybe the interpretation we have at this stage won't be kept at on the physical phase space, on the physical Hilbert space. And yeah, right now we cannot really. But depending on how seriously you take this operator, the meaning of these operators, just keep in mind that indeed they are not Dirac observables. Okay. So the next step, very quickly, in the Dirac program is, so we still need to impose these two constraints. And so we know how to impose the special difference. So the next step, and I'm just going to give you the result. So we want to more or less solve. So now it's on the spin network. And we can use a kind of similar method to the Gauss or the flatness constraint. But again, as for the flatness constraint, here we get some non-compact gauge orbit. So we have to be careful. But the solution here of applying this is what we call S naught or abstract spin network state. And what are that? So just with words, what does it mean? So in fact, here S naught is in fact the equivalence class S of embedded, because here your spin network is embedded in your 3D surface, okay? And under so the action of default. So here S naught is, let me just write the definition, is equivalent class. Of embedded spin network. Okay. Under the action of diffeo. Under diffeo, but just for your surface, your hypersurface sigma. So this means that here S and S prime belong to small s, to the equivalent class, if you can get a diffeo. Which is going to relate the two. So of course, you're not going to see anything here. So you get a diffeo on this surface that has so So what in what does it mean more or less in practice? So this means that really S0 is really an abstract graph, and it's defined only by agency relation between links and nodes, okay, by the coloring, and also if you're dealing with a surface with a non-trivial topology where you have, for example, handles or I don't know what you can get. So, and also if you get nodes between different speed networks. So this is, so all this information is kept. But so what you know, you still know how many loops in the graph, for example, you have. If you have a holes, how many loops around the holes you get, or how many edges are going to intersect. You're going to know how many nodes and how they're related. But where the graph sits inside the manifold, its location, the metric property, and all this information. So for example, the edge lengths are not now well-defined property, okay? So it's really just agency relation, the fact that you have a crossing, that you have two nodes that are related, that you can have a loop, or if you have a manifold, for example, which is torus, how many loops you have around here. So all this information is kept. But really, where this graph is sitting on the manifold, the length, all metric information now is not well defined. Okay. So, and so what is the S naught? So S naught is now you, what you have imposed here is the Gauss constraint and the special diffeo. Okay. So it's an invariant field of the Gauss constraint and the special diffeo for the gravitational field. And it's really only an algebraic quantum state of the gravitational field. So now each link can be seen as, again, carrying a quantum of area and the node carrying a quantum of a quanta of volume. And it can really be seen as an elementary excitation of space, okay, where now space is formed by chunks of quantized volume separated by a sheet of area here. And but what is important is that, yeah, this S naught does not live on a manifold, but it's defined. And you cannot ask the question where, because it's the where more or less itself. Okay, so this is what is a bit difficult to understand comparing to what you used to, is that this is really the quantum excitation of space-time. Okay, so you cannot say I'm on space-time. This is space-time. Okay, so you don't have somewhere because you don't have some background to answer this kind of question. So the only question you can really answer is really the relation between algebraic object here. So are they related? Do you have a crossing? Do you have a loop or anything like this? Okay. And of course, just to finish, so the next step would be to implement the scalar constraint or Hamiltonian constraint. And of course, this is still an open problem. So then there are several suggestions, either using the master constraint or using the spin foam approach. And this is what I'm going to introduce tomorrow. Okay? So I guess I'm going to finish. Sorry for the.